You're listening to Central Time. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up on the Ideas Network, Milwaukee Bucks MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo is a superstar that helped lead the Bucks to an NBA championship this year. But his ascent to stardom was far from a sure thing. On the morning show, they talked to Miran Fader, author of Giannis, The Improbable Rise of an NBA MVP, tomorrow after 8. Now, parenting presents you with a million choices, from decisions like how much screen time your kid should get, where they should go to school, or even what kind of parent you want to be. For many families, making their way through all of these decisions day to day can be chaotic and exhausting. But our guest says that there may be a better way if we approach those family decisions with a business mindset, especially as those kids grow between the ages of 5 and 12. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What are some of the big decisions you've struggled with as a parent? Maybe it's limiting screen time or deciding when to get your kid a cell phone. How did you go about picking where your kids go to school? Or did you only have one option? We want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Emily Oster is an economics professor at Brown University. She's also the author of multiple books, including her latest, The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early School Years. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've written a number of books about parenting, typically a little bit on the younger side, younger kids. Why did you want to write The Family Firm?
So my kids got a bit older, and I found that the data-oriented approach I was taking with younger kids was still helpful, but needed a little bit more scaffolding, that we were spending a lot of time thinking about logistics and trying to make decisions that were sometimes unexpected. And so this book is really an attempt to help families sort of think about, in that world of a lot of decisions and a lot of logistics, how can you craft a life that is going to make you happy, and how can you make some of those decisions deliberately, intentionally, thoughtfully?
And how does a business mindset factor in here?
I think the real insight, the real business parallel here, is the idea that when businesses, when firms make decisions, they have processes to do that, and they think about how any individual decision fits in the big picture of the firm. And I think that's, in many ways, the central lesson of the book, is that each individual decision we make should be part of a larger set, of a sort of larger vision of how we want our lives to look, rather than what I think we sometimes do in our households, which is make every little tiny decision on its own without thinking about how it will influence the whole shape of our day and of our years.
Well, let's look at that big picture, because you say that parents should engage with that and that families should engage with that. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that process will look like at the family level?
Yeah, so I think the big key is to have families think about, you know, at the end of the day, what do you want your day to look like? Do you want to be having dinner together as a family? Do you want your kids to be going to bed early? Do you want to be out doing a bunch of extracurriculars? Is it important to you that your kids play an intense competitive sport? Really thinking about which style of life do you want to have? Like, really, what do you want Tuesday to look like? What would be your ideal? And then, you know, being a little realistic about the constraints that we face. But I think that often we don't step back and really almost write down, what do we want our schedules to look like? And by doing that, we can then think, you know, hey, if I want to eat dinner every night at 6, maybe I can't do all these different extracurriculars. Maybe I actually need to do less in order to deliver a priority that may be more important to me.
Now, you were talking just a little bit about the sort of scaffolding that some of these decisions need, and you actually outline what you call the 4 F's. Can you talk step by step about what those are and how they work in this process?
Sure. So the idea here is to have a framework, a system for making kind of big decisions, things like what school should my kid go to? And the first F is to frame the question, to actually think about the specific choices you have, not just a sort of general what school, but actually let me define a couple of options. The second step is to fact find, to sit down and think about what does the data say about what makes a good school and which of these schools would better serve my kid, but also how would this fit into other aspects of our life? How would we manage logistics? Is this financially feasible? How would we make it work? You do that work. And then there's a third step, which is I call final decision, where I urge people to basically decide on a time to decide rather than letting the decision percolate and percolate and percolate and change all the time, to really say, get your data, make your decision, and then try to move on. Except there's a fourth F, which is follow up, which is the idea that we really, as in many of these, even these big decisions, they aren't permanent, they aren't forever. If you send your kid to one school, you can think about reevaluating that if there's another option, and that we should plan to do that reevaluation. We should accept the possibility that some of these decisions, even if we make them very thoughtfully, they could turn out to be wrong in the end, and we should be willing to change our mind. And that if we have an explicit plan for follow-up, then we will be more likely to make better choices and use the information we've learned from what has come before. So that's the four steps.
We are talking to Emily Oster right now, author of multiple books and an economist. Her latest book is The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early Years. And you're a parent. You've got two kids. Can you talk about how you have utilized this so far in your own life?
So I think there's kind of two pieces. One is that, you know, in our family, there are some things that are very central to us. So family dinner being kind of a big one. And that's important to us, not, I should be clear, not because of some secret thing in the data that if you don't have a family dinner, your kids will turn out terrible, but really just that it's very important to my husband and I. It's something that we enjoy, that we like to do. And so that's an aspect that we've prioritized, and that we partly prioritized by sort of sitting down and thinking about, okay, this is actually something that we want to do. We want to put ahead of almost anything else. And that influences our many other things. It influences what kind of extracurriculars we can do. It influences, you know, other choices that we make about how much we work and when we work and so on. So that's an example where I think being clear on what is important to us, in that case, not so much because of data, but just because of our preferences, has really changed or influenced how we run our days.
And you have included your daughter in part of this decision making. You know, some parents might say, hey, I'm in charge, I get to make all the decisions. But what do you think it says to have your kids have a say?
I think that having our kids have a say, at least for us, is very important, because then they will be more bought into they will understand where we're coming from, and they will be more bought into the choices that we make. And we don't, I want to be clear, like, we try to incorporate the kids after we have decided what the feasible options are. So we're just having an exchange today about, you know, what kinds of things would we do in the fall after school, and, you know, getting to a point where we had agreed, okay, we are comfortable with either this choice or this other choice. And so now we're going to bring it to our daughter and say, okay, like, let's talk about, you know, what's going to work, but within some scaffolding. So if she said, you know, I want to do my homework at midnight, that's just not an option because she needs to be asleep. And so there's a kind of limit to the choice, but I think giving kids that autonomy then prepares them for being adults, which for me is kind of a big part of how I think about approaching my parenting, is I'm trying to raise an adult, somebody who eventually, as sad as it makes me, will sort of leave me and be on their doing things on their own.
Right now, we are talking to Emily Oster. She's an economics professor at Brown University, and she's with us to talk about her latest book, The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early School Years. And this looks at how a business mindset and that sort of scaffolding that you might see in an office space might be able to be applied for some better, easier family decision-making. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you make decisions in your own family? Is it reactive and maybe a little chaotic? Or have you found a system that really does work well with you, and does what you're hearing from Emily really resonate? Call 800-642-1234. Again, that's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we'll continue this conversation and maybe hear from you in just a moment right here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson. Thanks for being with us. Right now, we are picking up our talk with economist and author Emily Oster about her latest book, The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early School Years. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you have any questions about Emily's methods or how she's approaching it, we want to hear from you. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Now, Emily, before the break, we were talking about how you have utilized this in your own family. And I want to look at just some examples because you have a lot of data about how some of these examples might shake out. And so let's talk about screen time, because that's a big thing that parents are concerned about. You hear study after study saying, hey, don't let your kids look at too much screens. So how do you approach screen time for 5 to 12-year-olds with your system?
So I think that the key thing in the data on screen time is to separate out two pieces. One is the information we have about the influence of content. And when you look at the how much it matters what kids are watching, some of the more sort of hysterical concerns, like if your kid watches violent stuff, they'll become violent, that doesn't seem to be very supported in the data. So that doesn't mean there isn't a role for kind of curating what your kids watch. Of course there is. But that the content piece, there isn't something that says, you know, you have to watch a particular kind of content. The other piece, probably more important in some ways, is to think about the fact that when your kid is watching TV, they're not doing something else. And so there's a displacement aspect of TV, that if your kid is watching TV for 6 hours a day, they're not, you know, doing their homework or going outside or doing some other things. And that those other things could deliver outcomes that you care more about, or that could be better for your kid in some way. And so I think there's a little bit of a kind of thinking carefully about how does this fit in? How does this time fit in your day? But that doesn't mean that there's no screens. In this, and the way I sometimes put it to people is, if your kid told you every night before dinner, I'm going to go upstairs and I'm going to stare at my wall for an hour, and I'm just going to be quiet, and I'm going to let you know, cook dinner, I'm just going to stare at the wall, you would be like, wow, my kid's such a great meditator. You know, they love meditating. That's so good for them. And in some sense, but it would still be displacing. You know, they still wouldn't be practicing the violin or doing their homework, but you wouldn't have the same feeling. And I think that there's a sense in which you kind of want to think about, sometimes we all need a downtime. Sometimes we need a break, and that the alternative may just be getting crankier and hungrier and people yelling. And instead, actually, some screen time is probably better. So I think there's, you know, like with everything, there's kind of a balance and really a value to thinking about where is this going to fit in the structure of the day, such that it can deliver some of those, you know, benefits, because screen time is nice, without displacing other things that you think are important.
Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of sort of balance that needs to be had when you are taking a lot of this into consideration, because, you know, I'll admit this, I am not a parent, but I read a lot about parenting as part of my job, and because it's interesting. And, you know, there's a lot of conflicting information out there about what you should and you should not do. And so one of the things I'm curious about is, how does your framework, I guess, kind of fit into the overall, hey, parenting is tough, here's an idea?
I mean, I think it's one idea. You know, I think that in the book, I try to sort of push in the direction of having some things that are actionable, both in the sense of having data that is actionable. So, you know, not all of the data is perfect, but there are pieces like what do we know about sleep, or what do we know about, you know, how kids learn to read, things where you actually, there is some concrete action, some choice that you might make differently if you knew this. And then I think the second piece is, again, to sort of try to be very practical, even about some of these kind of abstract, big picture planning things. So, you know, rather than saying something like, you know, think about all your, like, you know, how you want your life to look in an abstract way. I say that, but then, you know, there's a piece of this that says, actually, you kind of should write down like what should happen in the different hours. So I think there's a practicality that comes from the fact that I am an economist, and therefore drawn to the practical.
We're talking to Emily Oster right now. As she said, she is an economist. She's also an author. Her latest book is The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early School Years. Now, you've also written a lot about the different kinds of parenting styles. Parents obviously want the best outcome for their kids, but how they execute it might be very different. Of course, we've heard about, authors and scholars like Amy Chua when she is a self-described tiger mom, so a little bit more strict. Then you have the helicopter parent, and then you also have, on the opposite end of the spectrum, you have free range parents. Can you just talk about, you know, the different range of styles and how that also fits in?
So there are, of course, many labels that we put on parents. I don't like the idea of labels because I feel like somehow it makes us have to choose. And that, in fact, you know, you could be a person who, you know, cares tremendously about like doing extra tutoring and also a person who has some more kind of free range kind of things where you want to give people more, you want to give your kids more, you know, physical autonomy, physical freedom. So I don't think that we should have to choose this. I think there is in the data, again, a sort of like a little bit of an up the middle compromise when we think about independence. So on the one hand, some scaffolding and involvement in, say, kids' educational experiences seems to deliver better outcomes for kids, seems to have them, you know, perform better in school, do better in general, less likely to have sort of bad things happen. But on the other hand, it also seems clear that it is possible to be too involved, and that kids, particularly in college, when they sort of perceive their parents to be too involved, that can lead to anxiety, depression, and a sort of general sense of unhappiness, at least in the data. So I think there's sort of some happy medium here, which is part of why the idea of like, I'm going to be this kind of parent I don't think we need to make people choose. I think you could do worksheets and still let your kid walk home alone.
And it also sounds like you can adapt over time. You can evolve, as you have said, as part of your own scaffolding. Not all these decisions are permanent. You can always keep learning. Can you, I want to get back to some of the data because I know that there are parents out there that are really grappling with this. So in two parent households in particular, many of them weigh the pros and cons of both parents working or perhaps one parent staying at home. Can you talk about the data that you found and how people might be able to, you know, apply that to their own situations?
Yeah. So I think often the question people ask is, you know, well, what's going to happen? Like, what's good for my kid? And, you know, I think it should first be clear that that's only a part of this, that, you know, there are other reasons why parents would choose to work or not to work. Maybe they like it. There are financial reasons that people make these choices. So, you know, thinking about what is going to deliver some particular outcome for my kid is only a really small part of this. When we look at something like test scores, there are, you know, some studies that'll show you that, you know, working is good for kids' test scores. Some studies will show you working is not good for kids' test scores. Maybe it varies what kind of family it is, but all of those effects are tiny. So like if they're positive, they're tiny, they're negative, they're tiny, they're on average about zero. There just isn't much in the data that would say that this matters for how your kid performs in school. There's actually a little bit more evidence that maybe kids who have two working parents are slightly more likely to be overweight. Although again, those effects are fairly small. And they seem to have a lot to do with what your kid is doing after school. So thinking, you know, carefully a little bit about making sure that your kid is, you know, active, even if you are both working is part of that. But on the whole, I would say this lets people off the hook a little bit in the sense that it says, really, this decision should be something about what works for the family, not something about one of these things being the right way to parent or the better way to parent.
You know, as you delved into this book, was there any data out there that actually surprised you?
There's a lot of data on the best way for kids to learn to read, and I hadn't thought that much about it, but there's just very, very strong evidence in the direction that we should be teaching kids with a phonics-based approach, that phonics is just like really, really important in learning to read. And that isn't how it's always done, but it makes a tremendous amount of sense when you dig into it. And I think I found that both surprising and also, you know, quite actionable as a person who was at the time I was doing this trying to teach one of my children to read.
And Emily, as we start to wrap up, you know, what is one thing that you really hope that parents take away from your book?
I think, you know, in a sense, when you write a book that's like, this is like run your family like a business, I think people's first thought is like, oh, this is a book about using spreadsheets to make my kids do more soccer. And like, I don't need another book about spreadsheets to make my kids do more soccer. But I actually think what I would like people to take away is almost the opposite. That basically using intentionality, doing this deliberately, is actually a way to do less, if that's what you want, is a way to sort of think about what are the things that are important. And particularly as we kind of move, I don't know, out of the pandemic, I don't exactly know how to put it at this point, but as people sort of recover from last year and return, particularly with kids, to kind of more of a normal school schedule and so on, and there's an opportunity to think about, of all the things we were doing before, if there were many of them, which of them do we want to introduce and to reintroduce? And are there things that we were doing that we now actually don't want to do anymore? And that there's a moment for being thoughtful about those choices.
Emily, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Emily Oster. She's an economist and the author of multiple books about parenting. And she was with us today to talk about her latest book, The Family Firm, A Data-Driven Guide to Better Decision-Making in the Early Years. You are listening right now to Central Time on the Ideas Network.